Paul Duane's Irish folk horror film, All You Need Is Death, is now playing in select theaters and on digital from XYZ Films. Beyondfest says, "You'll never be able to hear another folk tune without shivering in fear." David Jenkins of Little White Lies calls it grimly refreshing and confident. You can tell that everyone involved in the making really understood and appreciated the assignment. Watch the genuinely horrifying All You Need Is Death, available everywhere you buy movies.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today, we are tackling one of the most infamous cases of a horror film trapped in Development Hell, and that is Guillermo del Toro's never-made big-budget adaptation of At the Mountains of Madness. This is an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, so that means it's already going to be difficult to achieve. And it's also a Guillermo del Toro adaptation. And there are just so many awesome Guillermo del Toro projects stuck in Development Hell, and we appreciate that. Today, we are going to use some information from the KingCast, IndieWire, and Wikipedia, so check out our show notes if you want more information. We have with us today a very exciting returning guest judge. We have Drew Tinnant. He is a staff writer here at Dread Central and just a really important voice in horror journalism. So we're excited to have him back. Drew, how's it going?
It's going well. I'm glad somebody thinks I'm an important voice in horror journalism.
That's good.
I appreciate that. I've definitely been doing it a while. So if that counts for something.
I think it definitely does. Drew, can you do me a favor? And in case anyone's forgotten, can you reintroduce yourself to the Development Hell audience?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, let's see. I started in the horror space probably like over 10 years ago. When I was in New York, I started working for Fangoria and did their show Fangoria Radio, which is a real blast. We had Guar in studio and did all kinds of fun things and wrote for Fangoria for a while. Then came across Dread Central. I did my first piece for them. It was a whole thing on William Castle at the Film Forum. And I've been writing for Dread Central ever since and covering film festivals all over the place and doing tons of interviews and listicles, you name it.
Amazing. Yeah, we're big fans of yours here. And so much so that we've actually had you on the podcast before. People might remember that you joined us for a Stephen King episode when we talked about his short story, The Jaunt, which is like probably my favorite short story ever. And today we're doing H.P. Lovecraft. So we've kind of narrowed you into a bit of a literature niche. How do you feel about that?
I love this. And it's going to be inspire me for future episodes, hopefully. But it is funny to talk about Stephen King and Lovecraft, because a lot of their stories, you know, in one shape or another have been kind of made or at least alluded to. So it's nice to find a couple of them that haven't.
And there is a lot of there's an interesting dynamic between their works. And we're going to get to that a little bit down the line. Today, I want to tell everybody that we are going to cover a couple of different subtopics. So we're going to talk about H.P. Lovecraft because there's a lot of baggage and interesting stuff going on there. We are going to talk in detail about At the Mountains of Madness because I forced us to read the entire novella today and we have thoughts. And then, of course, we're going to get to The Moneymaker. We're going to talk about Guillermo del Toro's still unmade adaptation of At the Mountains of Madness. Drew, would you be okay if we dove into a little bit of history on H.P. Lovecraft?
I can't wait. I actually didn't, you probably say this, but I didn't realize that how destitute he kind of was during his life.
Yeah, he had a really, I guess that makes sense based on his work, but he's had like a really messed up life that ended, unfortunately, quite young. This dude was born in Providence, Rhode Island, what a spooky place, and lived a lot of his life in an even spookier place, New England, which, like, am I wrong to say that this is basically the center of American spooky fiction, New England? Because you got Stephen King and Lovecraft?
Yeah, I mean, I think with those two powerhouse names, you know, that's almost all you need.
And that with all of the lighthouses, I mean, how much spookier can you get?
It's true.
Speaking of spooky, both of this dude's parents were institutionalized in his young life, which couldn't have been fun for him. Sounds traumatic. I don't know, very like Tim Burton character of him. So kind of adds to the whole oeuvre. He was a writer, but during his time alive, wrote mostly just pulp fiction in a lot of like sort of lower class pulp magazines and literary magazines that people didn't really show a lot of respect. He spent time in New York City, but and maybe you could speak to this, but New York City took like a big toll on his mental health and his financial health.
I can so totally relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah. You just said you lived in New York City for what, like a good chunk of your life?
Yeah. I was in New York for about 10 years.
Okay. So you can relate to Lovecraft's journey in New York?
I made it out in better shape though. For sure, okay. Sounds like.
Well, it seems like once he left, he actually started to produce some of his best work. Once he made it out to New England, he started writing things like The Call of Cthulhu, At the Mountains of Madness, The Shadow Out of Time, and a lot of other really iconic works. He would continue to write until his death of intestinal cancer at the age of 46, which is so young. And throughout his entire life, he was never really able to support himself fully on his work as a writer and as an editor. He was virtually unknown during his entire lifetime and was just published through pulp magazines before his death, and then became quite a cult figure after he passed, which is always so sad. Did you know that he, during his time alive, he was basically unknown and kind of destitute?
I thought that he had gained some fame before he passed away, actually.
Me too.
But yeah, it did take a little bit longer. But I don't think it was much longer, though.
Like after which is death. Almost like, what a bitch. Like, you die, and then you never know. You never know what the world all of a sudden became super obsessed with you and the huge impact that you had. It's almost like
what happens to painters instead of authors.
Yeah. And painters usually have that, you know, tragic sensibilities. He's got it. I'm wondering, Drew, if you could maybe walk us through some of like the more well-known or important themes in H.P. Lovecraft's work.
Yeah. I mean, I think the main thing that everybody knows is cosmic horror and the idea of, you know, cosmicism, which is a term that an ism that I don't really use very often. But it's the idea that argues that humanity is an insignificant part of the universe. And that we could all be killed and crushed and just obliterated at any moment.
Do you agree with this? Is that something that you align with?
It's starting to feel more true lately. And I like, you know, it's just like that we're just very fragile and delicate and, mm-hmm. you know, just hurtling through space. But the term, I wanted to talk about the term cosmic horror a little bit, because I think it gets overused a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to kind of pinpoint exactly what it means, but I think people kind of know it when they see it, which is ironic because a lot of the cosmic horror and Lovecraft stuff, you don't get to see anything. You just get to, there's very vague descriptions of creatures and the, you know, the really, darkest depths of, you know, terror, are in like the descriptions and it's really about what you don't see. But I like the term vastness horror, which I think is like kind of coming around a little bit more, because I think that tends to show you that it's a term that I prefer, because it's not overused, and it's more about the fear of like the infinite than a fear of space. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you like that term? Do you like the term vastness horror over cosmic horror?
I think I like both. I see them as, I see how they are this very similar, but I can also see them as maybe being slightly different things. And vastness horror is something that I think, even just by the hearing the word, is something I can kind of relate to. I have like a, well, we did this episode on The Jaunt, and I feel like The Jaunt, Stephen King's short story, is like complete vastness horror, almost in like a literal way.
Yeah, no, I thought that too. And obviously, you know, Stephen King was inspired by Lovecraft as well. But yeah, especially with when you're talking about The Jaunt and the teleportation and the endless, mm-hmm. endless amount of time. But I think that's the vastness horror aspect. Yeah, I think that it does have to do with time a little bit. And, you know, cosmic horror that Lovecraft does deal with, admittedly, is not really about that. It's really more about, you know, these ancient creatures, you know, and that we've kind of, you know, come up from the primordial ooze of them in a way, which is the scariest thing to me about cosmic horror and that idea is that it's the fact that eventually they want to absorb us again. That's the part that gets mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that I don't care where we came from. You know, I know it's a big question, but I really don't care. But if something wants to assimilate me, I'm not down with that.
No, because we have like no sense of like control at that point. It's terrifying. Mm-hmm. I think they say it in The Mountains of Madness, but there was some Lovecraft quote out there where he says that there were some like great monstrous entities out in the universe that created us either on accident or as like a joke. I don't like that. It's always kind of scary.
Yeah, and we can maybe get into that a little bit later, how that, you know, Ridley Scott kind of played around with that, you know, and you know, Prometheus.
It's funny that you brought up Prometheus, because it actually plays a bit of a dramatic role in why Guillermo del Toro's adaptation of this film didn't happen, which is classic Ridley Scott being a dick. and I'm excited for that to get sort of braided into this. But
definitely. But I think you're right. Like, if we talk about more themes, I think it's, mm-hmm. I guess they all kind of come together a little bit, but yeah, it is definitely the fear of the unknown. And you did mention New England earlier too, that another kind of Stephen King parallel is that his, you know, his works were largely set in this fictionalized version of New England, the mm-hmm. Arkham kind of trilogy and the, some mm-hmm. of the things that he did. And also that, yeah, he believed that the West was in decline during his lifetime, which I didn't really realize that. So I thought that was an interesting kind of idea that I think he kind of, I don't know if that's in his, in the Mountains of Madness specifically, but I think in his writings and in his notes and talking about the work, I think that came out a little bit more.
Yeah, definitely. And there's some stuff in the Mountains of Madness where we learn about the ancient beings and how their civilization kind of did crumble eventually, and some of them retreated to the sea. There's some interesting stuff in there about downfalls in a way, but pretty vague.
Yeah, it's kind of what happened. It's they don't really get into that mystery, I guess, as much, but they do find out that there was a lost civilization there that was kind of completely destroyed too.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, before we get into like the more nitty gritty of this person, H.P. Lovecraft, if we could talk a little bit about our personal relationships with him, with his work, with even just him as like this figure in the horror zeitgeist. For me personally, like, I've always been very fascinated with the idea of Lovecraft, but I've never really dipped into reading him that much. I've read a few of the short stories before today and kind of had a hard time, focusing, kind of had a hard time like getting into it. And today when we read The Mountains of Madness was the first time where I really kind of absorbed a longer work of his. Definitely fascinated by the fear of the unknown. I'm definitely fascinated by cerebral horror. I'm wondering, like, how do you feel about Lovecraft? What's been your journey with him?
Well, I like the idea of that kind of the, you know, horror theater of the mind a little bit, you know, where I think he does a really good job of like creating these very scary concepts. But I don't know if it's exactly like amazing world building. I think he does an insane amount of descriptions. And I think sometimes that can be a little bit challenging to read. And the fact that it was written in the 30s, you know, he just has a different way of, mm-hmm. of writing. I think it's kind of hard to adjust to. And, you know, he didn't have much of an editor. I think, there are versions of At the Mountains of Madness that, you know, there's sentences added here and there, like some of the ones, I think it originally came out in Weird Tales. Mm-hmm. But there's been sentences and things kind of added over time, you know, that he's kind of worked on.
Used an editor, yeah.
I think so. But I actually heard the term Lovecraftian before I read Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was really in films that I became aware of him, you know, where it's like, you know, I knew Stuart Gordon. I was watching all that all the time, of course, with like From Beyond and Reanimator and everything. So that's when I really started hearing the term Lovecraftian. And then the term cosmic horror comes later. And then the man H.P. Lovecraft, I think I've heard more about recently too, just because of some of his views mm-hmm. and him kind of possibly being or definitely being racist at some point and then maybe changing his views later on. But mm-hmm. That's one thing that's interesting about trying to make his work or into a film and getting other filmmakers that can take these ideas and, you know, they don't have to talk about the man or some of those ideas that maybe were embedded in his stories.
Definitely. I feel like he is this infamous figure that we hear a lot about as like young horror fans. And I think some of the information is good and some of it is a little sensationalized. I remember hearing a lot about Cthulhu and mm-hmm. like hearing, you know, that was always a big touchstone of horror.
A lot of old gods, yeah.
And like the idea of a scary monster that's so grand and so vast and so unknowable that if you look at it, you just go completely insane, which that's beautiful. Like, yeah. what a great idea.
Yeah, you're so, right. It is beautiful. It really is. It's not,
yeah.
It's frightening, but that's kind of why it's beautiful.
Yeah. And like the idea of these giant monsters in outer space that like are just so indifferent to our puny, like terrible existences. That's always kind of spooky. I remember hearing as a kid that like the big themes in Lovecraft were like fish and vaginas. And I was like, whoa, really? Now I'm thinking that that's not so much the case. I don't think like the fear of women or the fear of like the woman's body, maybe it is in other works. I don't know. But that was always something I remember hearing, that it was like he had a bad relationship with his mom, and now there's like all this weird vaginal themes in his works.
That's interesting, because like I kind of was aware of that too, but it was also around the time that Alien came out, and it was H.R. Giger who was definitely obsessed with vaginas.
yeah.
You know, in his work. So you start seeing that in Alien, which is an obviously, you know, big, mm-hmm. it takes a lot from Lovecraft. But
yeah.
And then speaking of Del Toro, I mean, he's got that amazing full, like, full scale, you know, wax figure or whatever it is at a Bleak House at his home. That's like H.P. Lovecraft at a desk writing, I believe.
Oh, I was wondering if you'd ever seen the Guillermo del Toro art exhibit at Home with Monsters. I know they toured a bunch of different cities with it.
I didn't get to see it, unfortunately, but I definitely picked up Cabinet of Curiosities, his book that came out by Matt Zoller Seitz, that came out a few years back. So that's got a mm-hmm. big section on Bleak House, if I recall.
Yes, definitely. And there's like, yes, yeah, so you get to like walk through like some, I believe, Bleak House reconstructions. And my favorite room is, and I think it is a room in his house, where it's this beautiful, like super gothic Victorian office, like writing office. but all of the windows are false installations of thunderstorms. So it's this like this like big Gothic Victorian library where it's always like a dark thunderstorm outside.
Right. And I think is that supposed to be his rain room?
Yes, the rain room. Yes.
Yeah, because like, I remember being at South By and Guillermo del Toro was interviewing Ryan Gosling, and I was covering that for another site. But I was just really surprised when Ryan Gosling talked about the rain room, and I think at that point I'd never heard about it before, so I thought it was pretty incredible.
That's cool. We covered the Never Made Guillermo del Toro Haunted Mansion movie on this podcast at one point. And I think, yeah, he was supposed to star in it. He was supposed to star Ryan Gosling. I really wish I could have seen that.
They could have just shot at his house. They could have just shot at Bleak House. And remember that they, I can't even remember which fire it was. I lived in San Francisco for a while too. So I've been around the fires a lot. Bleak House was in danger of burning down. Do you remember this? Like a couple of years ago?
No.
And every horror fan on Twitter was, you know, concerned just in general for all the acreage that was going on. But yeah. They were specifically concerned about Del Toro's house, and he kept kind of updating fans and saying that the fires were kind of licking the building a little bit. But luckily nothing was harmed.
I didn't see that conversation. That sounds
Lovecraft
really fascinating.
Is okay. Yeah, Lovecraft did not burn.
God, I'd love to visit that house. I really relate to this man. I would really just love to become him at one point, and I could see it happening. So please pray for me. So Drew, would you be comfortable if I dig a little bit into why Lovecraft is such a problematic fave?
No, I want to get into it.
So I guess why is it important to discuss his well-documented racism? In my opinion, it's so that we get to talk about him, because I haven't read that much Lovecraft in my life, I do consider myself to be really fascinated with him as a figure, really fascinated with his work, and ultimately, you know, a fan. So I just want to be able to have conversations about him. But I do think it's important when we do that to be honest about his pretty terrible racism. And I think that's what we're about to jump into now. So I think it's well known that Lovecraft is or was a fairly racist individual and had left a lot of written racist remarks against people that were not white. And there has been some scholarly argument that these were just the common attitudes in America around that time, specifically in New England, which I find interesting. I'm not sure why New England would be more racist than other parts of the country. That's just something I have to accept, I suppose. But either way, everyone was racist. He was racist. It kind of doesn't make up for it. He was allegedly even semi-pro-Hitler in the early days of the Nazi Party. And again, this was not specific to Lovecraft. I think the majority of Americans were at least interested in what Hitler was having to say until he, you know, started becoming more and more violent. And it is said that once H.P. Lovecraft got word that there was violence against Jews in Germany, that he completely changed his mind. But the fact that at any point he like thought this guy had something to say, I think is a little indicative to what was going on in Lovecraft's head at the time. He showed sympathy to cultures that were not white, but that like expressed interest in like joining the Great Melting Pot. He is like kind of famously married a Jewish woman, to which he unquote described as being well assimilated.
When you say well assimilated like that, that just comes off like, you know, like she did an acceptable job of mm-hmm. you know, appearing white. So that's a dicey term.
Oh, it's very dicey. It's terrifying. But it showed that he was okay with you if you're not white or not Christian, as long as you like adapted to the white Christian lifestyle, which is kind of like the American melting pot system still to this day. So as we were saying, very, very problematic. Although it is believed that as he grew older and as he traveled more, his views on ethnicity somewhat moderated. But as we said, he died really young. And so there wasn't really that much of a journey that he could have made. Like, it's unfortunate. He was, like, clearly just a very racist individual. And that was, to some degree, a product of his time. But what's so disappointing is that, like, he has all of this on record. So, product of his time or not, it's just proven that this dude was racist as hell. And it's impossible not to look at his work through that lens, at least to some degree. And it kind of, like, it's a little bit of a rain on the parade. But, you know, it's important to remember.
Yeah, and that's one thing about being a writer. You write a lot, and so all of your views are right there for everybody to take a look at.
Okay. Do you ever think about, for us, that, like, there's just so much of our thoughts on the internet that, like, you know, hopefully they all age well.
Yeah, luckily, I guess, you know, a lot of them aren't too evergreen, because it's mostly covering, you know, pretty, you know, yes, recent things in the world of horror and genre and stuff. So, you know, once it's read, it's definitely somewhere out there in the outer space of the internet.
But there's a lot of it. Drew, I kind of want to talk about the adaptations of his work. Do you think that you could maybe run us through some of the more well-known film adaptations of H.P. Lovecraft's work?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's, like, direct ones, and there's ones that are kind of, you know, other filmmakers wanting to do Lovecraft and realizing a studio wouldn't let them, which sounds familiar, but and so they had to kind of throw these ideas into, like, more of a big budget kind of shell. But I mean, Reanimator for sure, From Beyond is the big one. Those are the two, like, that's when, like, every kid in the 80s knew who Lovecraft was at that point. You know, I mean, Stuart Gordon and Brian Usna, I mean, those are two classic films that don't look like anything else. And the people had never seen creatures like that. And it came at the kind of golden age of creature effects, I think.
Yeah.
For practical effects. I don't think a lot of people would argue with that. And the most recent one is Nick Cage's Color Out of Space. And talk about a, you know, problematic person.
I mean,
filmmaker now is unfortunately very, very problematic. Richard Stanley.
Yeah.
And then Dagon is one that, when do you remember seeing Dagon for the first time? Because I was, like, a kid, and then I
was a
child about it. Yeah.
It was a direct to video moment in, like, 2001. So I must have been, like, 10.
Yeah, I that's one that I need to revisit again, which is glad I'm so glad we're talking about Lovecraft, because there's a few things, like, there's now more of a book list and more of a movie list too.
Yeah.
That never
I
ends.
Dagon being a kind of a direct to video moment, if I recall specifically, about fish people. That's all I can remember.
Yeah, there's the one that I liked a lot that seemed to be on a lot was Necronomicon. That was with David Warner. It was a kind of an anthology that, and Brian Usna produced that too. So they used the Book of the Dead in that. And then of course they did. I was going to talk about this later with, like, you know, some better, just like some of our favorite stories, but the Dunwich Horror. That was I think the Dunwich Horror in 1970, that was like Dean Stockwell and Ed Begley and Sandra Dee, I think.
Oh, really? That's interesting. I'd like to see some more major ones, but maybe there's a reason that we haven't been able to. A, maybe it's just, like, unadaptable, and that's okay. And B, like, maybe this isn't the right era to be adapting a mega racist. Like, maybe it's just not exactly the right time.
Well, that's what's nice about other filmmakers kind of going in and trying to tackle his work a little bit, you know, like Lovecraft County, you know, and Lovecraft Country. And then I think even Barbara Crampton herself she's been trying to get a Lovecraft project off the ground that I don't think we can kind of reveal who the director maybe that she's talking to about it. But I think they're trying to get that going. So hopefully that'll happen, because she's the perfect person to, you know, produce you know, a Lovecraft adaptation.
Interesting. Before we move on into talking At the Mountains of Madness, is there any other Lovecraft adaptations or even just works inspired by his stuff that you think we need to touch base on?
I mean, I think you have to talk about the Thing and Alien. a little bit, but I think everybody already, I think people that are listening to this podcast, I think already know that. But Carpenter did kind of famously work in the Antarctica idea. And I mean, this, it goes straight into In the Mouth of Madness, of going and investigating kind of another, trying to find out what happened to another group or another civilization or something that happened. And then discovering the same horror that they discovered, that setup is at the Mountains of Madness. And it's been in a lot of sci-fi movies, a lot of horror movies. And it's that's definitely like maybe not the origin, but it's pretty close of that kind of setup.
Yeah. And just before we jump into At the Mountains of Madness, the idea of Antarctica is just not something that ever particularly struck me as interesting. I mean, the thing is fantastic and a classic. And I just, like, I've never really thought about it as, you know, a horror trope or as a horror space. But when you're starting to list these locations that summarize the fear of the unknown, you have the depths of the ocean, you have the, like, the trenches of outer space. And then, of course, Antarctica makes sense as something to belong on that list, especially if you consider the fact that when H.P. Lovecraft was really fascinated with Antarctica, that continent had not been explored yet. It was still, like, literally this continent of the unknown, which gives this book that we're about to talk about even more weight. This idea that there's this complete frozen continent on our planet that nobody has explored and anything could be out there. Pretty chilling, and I guess pun unintended.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you definitely think like what ancient thing might be down there frozen for a long time, you know.
Yeah.
But it is interesting though. I mean, like Lovecraft was obviously aware of Byrd's expedition and to the South Pole, and that was late 20s, like 1929.
Mhm.
So
very aware. I think he was actually like a little obsessed with that. And I think listed that by name in the Mountains of Madness.
Right.
So,
and then no one even like returned. I think, I don't think anybody went back to the South Pole until I think in the 50s. And I think that's because of World War II. I guess they just kind of stopped explorations like that.
It's kind of like the moon. Once you get there, like, do you really need to go back?
We found it. We planted a flag. What do you mean? What do you mean?
Yeah, there's not a lot going on over there. I do want to visit Easter Island at some point in my life. I don't know why. It just seems so remote that like I kind of like feel drawn to go, which I think is pretty close to down there.
Well, we can go together if you want.
Let's go. We can set up like Dread Easter Island. a little office down there. Drew, would you be okay if I jumped into a bit of a seminar on H.P. Lovecraft at the Mountains of Madness?
Absolutely.
So this book, or I guess a novella, is or was originally serialized into a group of short stories in the magazine Astounding Stories back in 1936.
Right, Astounding Stories, that was it.
Yeah. The basic gist of it is that you got this group of explorers going down to Antarctica, and it doesn't go well. The leads of the story are Dyer and Danforth. One is a scientist or a professor, and the other is a graduate student. And, it doesn't go great for them. It's all about Lovecraft's interest in Antarctic exploration. As we were saying, this continent had not really been totally fully mapped out until the 1930s. And so, like, this was ripe for him to sort of dig into thematically. There are things that occur in At the Mountains of Madness that recur in other Lovecraft stories. I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, but we have these, like, formless, iconic creatures by the name of Shoggoths. Am I saying that horribly wrong?
I always think Shoggoth, but it's not something you – the actual gods and creatures are not – things that you hear out loud a lot, you know?
No, and I think it's probably like unpronounceable, and if you pronounced it properly you'd go crazy.
That's right. So hopefully we both just pronounce it incorrectly.
I hope so. Or but you know what an iconic way to lose our minds.
That's true.
So yeah, you'll and you also learn about like Cthulhu lore in this, like his star foe. I forget what the name of Cthulhu's people are called. Something about some form of star people of some kind that right. eventually retreat to the ocean. So that's also touch base here. So his extended universe is definitely tightened with this book in a lot of ways. So that's kind of cool. I didn't know if I was going to try to do this, and I was going to maybe make you do it, but do you think it would be absolutely atrocious if I tried to give a brief summary of what happens in this book?
Yes, give it your best shot, and I'll try to jump in too.
Okay, when I mess up, can you please correct me? Because I did my best to understand what was going on in this book, but I'm not fully literate, and so I'm only about halfway there.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Okay, so At the Mountain of Madness is this story that's narrated in the first person by a geologist professor. His name is William Dyer, and he wants more than anything to stop this very well-publicized expedition that's going to happen to Antarctica. So the device or the narrative setup is Professor Dyer explains to this group of scholarly figures about this horrible thing that happened to him on a previous expedition to Antarctica, where he ran into some real spooky ancient ruins and this, like, you know, mountain range of like truly unknowable horrors and evils. And so he starts to explain the story, and basically he's going down to Antarctica with this like really big group of people. There's like, you know, anyone that you would need on this expedition. You've got from graduate students to scientists to like who, whatever you need it, they're there. And so they're down there, and there's this point in their journey where a smaller group of professors sort of go off on their own and sort of explore and leave the main group behind. And when they do, they come across 14 prehistoric life forms that they cannot describe and are completely unidentifiable as plants or animals or some like unholy marriage of the two. And so there's 14 of these things, and they try to bring them back to the main camp. I believe 6 of them are intact, and a bunch of them seem obviously dead. And so what happens at that point is they end up getting back to the main camp, which is, I think, where they leave these prehistoric life forms. And they find that everybody else, that like all the normies that they left behind, have been murdered. So there's like a complete bloodbath of all of these men and all of these dogs that they brought along to help, and they're all gone. And so the graduate student who is helping Dyer, his name is Danforth, they together sort of believe that there is, you know, one man is behind this mayhem. There is one body that they can't find. I think his name is Gedney, and one of his dogs.
Right, and they think Gedney went insane, and so they're trying to locate
him.
Yeah, or his dog did.
Yeah, maybe the dog went insane and killed everybody. So they're like, I guess Gedney wasn't doing so good and just killed everybody and left. Like, that's the only thing that makes sense. But at the same time, they also notice that these prehistoric life forms are missing. Like, the ones that were intact are gone, and have like kind of set up this weird ritualistic looking star figure, and they're like, well, that's not good. Gedney's up to no good at all. And so they get into an airplane and they cross these mountains, which I think were known as the Mountains of Madness. And
right, and then the airplane was the Dornier airplane that was from Miskatonic, so the Miskatonic Institute.
Okay, how is it going so far? Am I making sense?
Yes. No, you are. You absolutely are.
Oh, yeah, it's just... thank God.
Yes.
I wasn't 100% sure if I absorbed all this properly, but I definitely enjoyed the journey, and I think that's what matters. So yeah, Danforth and Dyer are flying on this airplane that you mentioned, and they find this abandoned, I guess this giant abandoned city, but it's totally unrelatable to like anything that they've ever seen in human architecture before. And they go and they explore it. And I don't understand why they're like, well, everybody's dead, let's just do some science. But they do. And they explore this city that's, I think, like really big and vast, but empty. And it's totally like retro-futuristic. Like it looks like it could have only been designed by like aliens from the future, but with like big stones from the past, kind of is the vibe in my mind. And they're looking through it and they're starting to like read all these hieroglyphs that they're coming across. And on these
murals, a lot of hieroglyphs for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And which is very convenient that this whole city is just like covered in murals and hieroglyphs.
But they give you the exposition.
Yeah. And because it's like not that long of a book, so they kind of had to speed through it somehow. And they notice that a lot of what they're seeing on these hieroglyphs are like recognizable from the Necronomicon, including these lost people that they call the Elder Things. And so this is like one of the first monsters that we're learning about. And so as they learn more about these Elder Things, we learn that, you know, they had this big war with, unquote, the star spawn of Cthulhu and these other big monsters called the Migo. And shit went down with all of these scary monsters back in the day. And that's when they realized that the Elder Things are what they discovered. So when they discovered those like prehistoric, gross plant or animal things, those were Elder Things. And the ones that they uncovered that were intact came to life and killed everybody in their base camp for some reason or another.
Yeah, I think the Elder Thing is almost, I think Del Toro, I don't know if he was the first person to say it, but they're almost like cucumbers. You know, that's almost what they look like, these like huge, bizarre, like pulsating like cucumbers, you know, which doesn't sound that scary when you say that. Yeah.
But it kind of does sound scary when you say that, because like you can just see like pods and pus and weird bullshit that my brain does not want to have to like piece together, which I think is kind of the whole point. And so, okay, so we've got Danforth and Dire, and they're learning about these Elder Things, and they realize that they've like unearthed a bunch of them and it killed all of their friends, and they decide to continue exploring further into the Mountains of Madness and this ancient city that is like really messed up and scary and like just not giving them good vibes whatsoever, not at all. And they keep going. And there's like even more mountains that are even bigger and scarier than the Mountains of Madness. And I think they learn about this unknowable evil that exists even deeper into the realms that the Elder Things were scared of and that are just like the truly biggest bad that you could ever encounter. Stay clear of them.
There's always a bigger fish.
There's always, especially with H.P. Lovecraft. And so they find themselves, for some reason, maybe they're drawn psychically, who's to say, deeper into this like subterranean region that is continuously covered in these murals and these hieroglyphs. And they keep reading as they go along, and they find that that all the Elder Things were killed in this terrible struggle. And yeah, so this is where the Oogie Boogie really happens.
The Oogie Boogie.
This is where Oogie Boogie really shows himself. And they're deep into this like ice tunnel where they're learning all this stuff. At first we learn about the scary Elder Things and we're like, oh, those are the scary monsters, they're the bad ones. No, they are not. They're like, they're fluffy ponies in comparison to what we're about to meet. And this is where they meet what they identify, and we talked about it earlier, as the Shoggoths. Is that what we were calling them?
Yes.
And it is this ginormous, bubbling, pulsing, black mass of goo that is sort of like unknowable in its horror. And I'm almost done, I swear. I think the
You're doing fantastic. There's also the thing that the description too is also that they all have these kind of moving eyes that are happening constantly.
Yes.
They're also feeding off of these, like, this is where it's almost comical and could maybe have been left out, but that when the Shoggoths are actually feeding on these like 6-foot tall penguins that they've blinded, I guess, so they're easier prey. And so they're kind of just using them, and they just kind of roll over them and kill them at will.
Oh, yeah. There's all of these giant 6-foot-tall penguins with no eyeballs that are just like livestock, I guess, for the Shoggoths. And they're so sad. And I actually want one.
Yeah, well, they're actually real. Like, giant penguins are real. I mean, there was a 25 million year old penguin that was discovered in New Zealand, like in the 70s, that was over 4 feet tall. So not quite 6 feet, but I mean,
oh my God.
Still might have been growing.
I love him. I want a giant penguin. He can keep his eyeballs, though.
Next from Pixar.
Yeah, giant penguins, no eyes. I think something we missed about the Shoggoths is that they were originally used as a tool to help these entities build this, like, giant city back before we had levers and pulleys and bullshit. Like, there were these entities that could take any shape, any form, any mind thought. They were just this, like, thing that could help you do stuff. But of course, because they were so powerful, they sort of found independence and, like, killed everybody else and kind of took control. And they sound really scary and gross. So,
their essence, right? Their that kind of primordial space ooze that they have is hinted that it's kind of the can be used to create us, even potentially.
Yes, which is like gross. The idea that this like nasty space ooze is the whole reason that we exist in the first place. Mm. But it would make a lot of sense, ultimately.
We're all not stars. We're a Shoggoth.
Yeah, Moby. So these two, Dire and Danforth, they're running away from this Shoggoth who's like oogie spooky eyeball tentacle green arms are chasing them. And they get into their little airplane and they escape. They get out of there, and which is seems improbable. And they're flying away and they're flying off in the distance. And for some reason, Danforth decides that he wants to, like, turn around and see what is waiting for them in the vast distance behind them. And I think what he sees, correct me if I'm wrong, is not the Shoggoth, like, becoming all big and scary. But what he ultimately sees is this unknowable evil that has been hinted at a number of times through the hieroglyphs on their journey. That this, like, ginormous, completely unknowable evil that once you see it, you completely lose your mind. And that is what happens to Danforth. He looks back and sees something that just immediately causes him to go insane. And that's kind of how this story ends.
Yeah, and that's the thing that really sticks with you, right? I mean, with and when you think of Lovecraft, too, is like this unknowable thing that can drive men crazy. Yes. And that's frightening.
Definitely. I'm listening.
And it does have, you know, I guess biblical references too. I mean, or even like Greek mythology, where you see Danforth going insane is by looking back and seeing something truly evil. Like that's like the Greek tragedy of Orpheus.
Yes.
You know, where Hades instructed him not to look back, you know, when he rescued his wife, from hell. And then I think when he did, like, she just dropped dead.
Yes. Do they mention that reference by name in this book? I feel like maybe they do.
I think so. Yeah. It's hard to remember because there's so much exposition in this. Like, if I have any criticisms of it, the ideas are so incredible, but it's just overly descriptive. But in that way, it becomes meditative. You know, the way you're reading it, it's a really hypnotic kind of writing that does kind of drill down into you while you're reading it. And I think that is kind of intentional. And it does make those little reveals when they happen hit a little deeper.
I'm wondering, if you don't mind, like, what was your impression of the elder things? Like, what did they look like to you? Were they good? Were they evil? Were they, like, neutral? Like, what was the deal with them? Because I have a bit of a question mark around them in my mind.
Yeah, I guess you're supposed to. It's supposed to be a little bit of a mystery. But yeah, I mean, I think if what's an interesting parallel between Lovecraft and Del Toro is that they are both, Del Toro much more accomplished, but they're both artists. And you can see the drawings that Lovecraft had of the elder things and what they kind of looked like. And they did look kind of bulbous and strange and, you know, not mm-hmm. is like not the idea of this designs we think of now, the more tentacled direction. It was much more of like this kind of strange kind of cucumber thing, I think. So but I think it's interesting that like Del Toro, when in all his prep and the kind of infamous journals that he does, and all the drawings that he does, that Lovecraft did the same thing. And I don't know if Del Toro was inspired by that to start doing it in the first place, but he might have been.
And when it comes to this unknown evil at the end, am I right to differentiate that is different from the Shoggoth?
Yeah, I think so. Yes. Because I think the Shoggoths are just the almost minions in a way. They're much more powerful than that. But I think they're an idea of like, they're basically shapeshifters, right? But just like a very ancient version of that.
So is this unnamed evil, like the guy that built this entire city? It's like, this is like his crib, kind of? Is that your interpretation of it, or am I off?
I don't know. I don't like to think about it too much. when you think about it realistically, it's not very practical to have an unknowable evil that's building all of this, or can drive anything insane, especially things that maybe have been created by the Shoggoths and these other creatures. But there is definitely a hierarchy.
I have my one criticism here is that I feel like H.P. Lovecraft suffers a little bit from telling rather than showing. you can say all you want that something is this big unknowable evil, but like, I don't know. I need a little more than that. I want to like come to the conclusion that this thing is a big unknowable evil on my own. Like, you don't need to just like push it in my face. You know,
I guess if you want to personalize it though with Lovecraft, I mean, you did mention that his parents, went insane, or they at least they were crazy. So the unnamed evil might be, going insane, kind of personified in a way.
That's right.
And nobody really knows why you go crazy. You just do.
Especially back then, when like going crazy just meant you were on your period or something. But
exactly, we didn't really know much about the human brain or the body that much.
We just like brought out the leeches, and that was that. But,
that's right.
I do like it though. I do like it is spooky, and it is making you think, and it is making you draw your own conclusions. And I mean, I was scared when I was reading this. It did scare me more than I was expecting it to.
And all the beats are there. I mean, with you have to remember, it is an adventure story. It's just a so I can see how it can be a pretty incredible horror adventure.
I think I lost you. There you are.
Especially if it was directed by Del Toro.
And speaking of,
I could really imagine how it could be a great horror adventure.
Oh, big time. Would you be ready for us to sort of dip into Del Toro's unmade adaptation?
Definitely.
Before we dig into all of the facts about this film that never actually got made, I'm wondering if you have a favorite work of Guillermo del Toro.
It's probably Kronos.
Oh, interesting.
I think if all of Del Toro's English language films were in Spanish, I would like them more. Okay. I enjoy all of them, but stuff like Kronos just hits a lot harder for me. I don't know if he's like quite made an English masterpiece like that, but I think he has in his own language.
You could be right.
His first language, I should say.
I think it's a very fair argument to make. Pan's Labyrinth is just, one of the most beautiful, like, horror fantasy hybrids ever made. And
incredible, yeah.
I think we take advantage of it, but it's always there. But I'm going to have a hot take here. And my hot take is, I don't know if a hot take is just that I like something, but I loved Nightmare Alley so much more than like everyone else I know. Like everyone that I know and respect were actually quite cool on Nightmare Alley. But if I'm going to be fully honest with you, it was like hands down my favorite movie of 2021. There's just something.
I remember reading your review. You were definitely into it.
I really was.
I was too.
What were you? Because a lot of people that I like really, really respect what they think were just not into it, and it just wasn't working for them. But the way that he handles film noir was just like just so pitch perfect. Like he handles every trope there and every beat there with like with such precision and specificity. And ultimately, I find it to be like really scary and really unsettling and just so beautiful. I love that movie. Just love it.
Yeah, and what happens at the end, you know?
I mean, nothing good.
Not to spoil it completely, but it is there is kind of a crazed moment, you know, for sure.
That's right.
It could happen to be a little bit of a parallel. But yeah, I think just Nightmare Alley really works for me because of the circus aspect to it. And I think I know Kate Blanchett was saying that she was really attracted to the circus aspect of it and the camaraderie of the carnival. Because it reminded her of the theater, and she's like incredibly passionate about the theater and runs a theater.
Ironically, she got to participate in none of those scenes, but
yeah, true.
She's definitely one of my favorite parts of that film. So now that we've gotten a little bit about how we feel about GDT and a little bit about who he is out of the way, would you be okay if I gave a little bit of a seminar on his adaptation of At the Mountains of Madness?
Yes.
So it's been about 15 years now that Guillermo del Toro has been working to adapt At the Mountains of Madness. It has been greenlit by multiple studios. It has been rejected by multiple studios. And for some reason or another, has just been impossible to get off the ground. Initially, Warner Brothers turned down this project in the late 2000s because it was just way too high budgeted for an R-rated movie, specifically an R-rated movie that did not feature a romance of any kind. And Del Toro has gone on record saying that, like, it is absolutely counterproductive to put a romance or insert a romance into Lovecraft's work. It just cannot be done. And I think that, I mean, listen, I haven't read that much Lovecraft, but I agree. Like, it would just be such a bad move. So even though Universal initially turned down the project, they would sign on to it eventually with the contingency that Tom Cruise was going to star. And I think this is something that kind of makes sense. Tom Cruise is like the ultimate action hero of a generation. And this is a big story with a lot of action involved. And, you know, I think it could have worked. But because Guillermo del Toro refused to censor any of his vision, and there was an estimated $150 million budget, things started to crumble. One of the first signs that this project was not going to happen was back in 2012. And it was sort of known at the time that At the Mountains of Madness was going to be Guillermo del Toro's next project. But it was revealed through Guillermo del Toro's social media channels that Ridley Scott's movie Prometheus had to come out first. That for some reason or another, because they were so similar in theme, that Prometheus and Ridley Scott's movie sort of had to take, I don't know, Hollywood priority, and it had to come out first. And I forget what he said exactly, but it just reeked to me of Ridley Scott being a little bit of a bully, which he, I don't know, has been historically on other projects. And so I found that to be kind of sad.
Yeah, I mean, Ridley Scott's, you know, what happened with Neil Blomkamp's Alien continuation, that's definitely one that sticks out a little bit. But I think Del Toro said about it that it just the endings were too similar. The endings of Prometheus and his ending at the time, which if it gets made, I'm sure he'll rewrite. And probably not have the same set pieces and large set pieces that he did. I think it was just the endings were too close.
Giant donut chasing after Charlize Theron. That is a specific ending that you cannot do twice.
It's because both movies were expensive. That's why. And they were kind of a little similar.
Yes. And definitely, you know, as you were saying earlier, the whole Alien H.R. Giger Lovecraft vibe, definitely Venn diagrams a lot also. Mm-hmm. So two big esoteric outer space movies that probably shouldn't have happened at the exact same time.
Yeah, and Del Toro even, I mean, it's been 20 years or something, because I think he was even trying it right after Kronos. I mean, he did a, wrote a, like, set during the New World, like the conquest of the New World with conquistadors going to the Mayan ruins and then finding like a lost city underneath the ruins.
Cool. It's such a perfect project for Del Toro. The way, just hearing that out loud is just like, I want to see this. Mm-hmm. Can I give you a quote from Del Toro that he delivered to IndieWire in 2020?
Yeah.
So about the project and about this adaptation, he says, "It's difficult to tackle. We had James Cameron as a co-producer with me, and we had Tom Cruise to star, and we thought we were going to get it made, and it didn't happen. These are not decisions you make. Most of us filmmakers, we exist in a world that moves above our pay grade. People think that our careers is a series of decisions. Our career is a series of accidents happening with your decisions on top. You don't decide to do one movie instead of another." Oh, it breaks my heart. This poor man.
It's a nice insight into the industry.
It totally is. Mm-hmm. And it's true. Like, and he says it, you know, eventually he did get to make Hellboy and Hellboy 2 and incorporated some of the Lovecraftian themes, especially into the second one. And he was just like talking about how he's just grateful that that movie got made. And so as sad as it is that all of his other films didn't, you know, the ones that get made are sort of the ones that count. So Guillermo del Toro was featured on Fangoria's podcast, The Kingcast, in 2021, where he gives some updates about the screenplay that he wrote and what direction the film might take if he was continuing it today. So he had to say, the thing with mountains is, the screenplay I co-wrote 15 years ago is not the screenplay that I would do now. I need to do a rewrite, not only to scale it down somehow, but because back when I was trying to bridge the scale of it with elements that would make it go through the studio machinery. And I think what he's trying to say, or I think what he is saying here, is that at the time he had to make certain sacrifices to establish a big budget movie in Hollywood. You know, sort of like I was mentioning earlier with maybe putting in a romance or just doing things to appease the shadowy overlords. But he continues.
I could not imagine a romance.
No, my God, me neither. But you know, if it was made in 2012 with Tom Cruise, there would have been a romance in it if it had gotten produced. I just like it would have happened.
Yeah, you're right.
But he goes on to say that, "I don't think I need to reconcile that anymore. I can go far more esoteric and weirder with a smaller version of it. You know, where I go back to some of the scenes that were left out, some of the big set pieces I designed, for example, I have no appetite for. Like, I've already done this, that giant set piece. I feel like going into a weirder direction." So I think what he's saying here is that, you know, now, especially now where you can do a whole lot more with a whole lot less money, like, why not go Netflix and go medium or small budget and go as weird as you want?
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I know with the recent kind of shakeup at Netflix, but I think they'll be fine, and the deal's there. But you know, I think it's a 3 or 4 picture thing that Del Toro has with Netflix.
Yeah, he's done a lot with Netflix too, with all those like YA series that he's done, the animated ones.
Is Pinocchio is not going to be Netflix, is it?
Yes, it is.
The animated. It is, okay, the animated version.
Yeah, okay. And then, of course, there's his new series, The Cabinet of Curiosities.
Mm-hmm, which I will be watching every episode of for sure. And then I think he wants to do Monte Cristo. I think he wants to do Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, really? I didn't know. I forgot about that. Or I didn't know.
Yeah, I believe so.
All of these are perfect for him. Yeah, have you seen the trailer yet for Cabinet of Curiosities?
I haven't, no, but I'm going to watch it after we're done. That's great.
Check it out. Check cool. it
and
out.
I wonder. You know, Tom Cruise in the afterword of the book Cabinets of Curiosities, he says that he still wants to do the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and he's maybe a little closer in age now. I mean, I suppose he would play Dyer. And maybe if Dyer and Danforth, if they had a relationship, that could be interesting. Maybe make the ending a little bit more tragic. Who knows?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because I think in the same interview with the Kingcast, Guillermo del Toro says on Tom Cruise, I think the age has changed now. Tom is 15 years older, and I think that he'd prefer to go for younger, mostly unknown actors. So, but now that Tom Cruise has like officially retaken over the world with Top Gun, like it could be the reason this gets made. Like it could be the green light that he needs.
Yeah, he's even bigger. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that ever actually happens. I really hope it does, so we don't have to revisit this.
Me too. The final quote, I believe from the KingCast that Guillermo del Toro shared was, "I know a few things will stay from the original screenplay. I know the ending we have is one of the most intriguing, weird, unsettling endings for me. That's about four horror set pieces that I love in the original script. So, you know, it would be my hope. I certainly get a phone call every 6 months from Don Murphy going, are we doing this or what? What are you doing next or what? And I say, I have to take the time to rewrite it." So, pretty interesting. A lot of the times on this podcast, it's pretty clear that a movie isn't going to happen, but it just doesn't seem that way with Mountains of Madness. And so, Drew, I guess my first question for you is, are we ever going to see Guillermo del Toro at the Mountains of Madness?
I don't know. it's possible. I mean, with the streamers, you know, if it doesn't happen at Netflix, maybe it could happen somewhere else. I mean, if somebody wants to pull him away at some point. But because he's already pretty busy over there. But I'm sure... I think it'll if it does happen, it would have to be another picture or the last one that he did of this deal. So that's still years down the line. He's such a brilliant art director. So yes, it's going to happen.
Interesting. Is it even possible to adapt this properly?
No, I think you have to change a lot of things about it. I mean, I think you can stay true to the descriptions, which I know Del Toro will, but he'll probably be incorporating a lot of things from Lovecraft and maybe just be kind of a super Lovecraft movie, because I don't think there's going to be a lot of Lovecraft fans out there that are going to be getting their pitchforks out because it's
No. I don't think so either. No. I think he kind of has carte blanche to do what he wants. And I guess my last major question for you is, how would we want to see this made? Do we want to see this as like $150 million big budget epic at a studio? Do we want to see a small, weirder streamer television series? Like, what would be the perfect medium for this?
I'd like to see it as a long feature, like a good like 2.5 hour, 3 hour feature.
I agree.
And mid range, you know, it doesn't need to be $150 million, but I mean, I'm not a producer. So, I don't know what he needs to tell whatever story he's going to tell. But I think he should be able to get it. I mean, if the silver lining with some of these streamers is that they can make those kind of dream projects happen, like The Irishman, for example. So if they can do that for Del Toro, that would definitely make me continue to subscribe.
Me too. And I haven't let go yet. So keep me interested. Drew, where can you be found on the internet if you so wish to be found?
At Dread Central, and you can find me on Twitter at Drew S. Tinnin. It's T-I-N-N-I-N.
Okay, amazing. And we're going to have you back for another weird literature episode at some point because we got you niched.
I know, I can't wait. I'm going to start DMing you immediately.
I am psyched. Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review.